listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you in our third hour today. Senator Sherrod Brown is going to drop by. In our second hour, Mike Papantonio, attorney and host of Ring of Fire Radio, is going to say hello. And it's Anything Goes Sunday. Senator Brown is working with Senator Vitter on some legislation about banks, by the way. As I said, we'll get into that in the third hour. And the NRA is speaking now about the Zimmerman verdict. This is very interesting. I mean, think about it. On the night of February 26, 2012, what did Trayvon Martin need that he didn't have? He needed a loaded gun. After all, as the NRA pointed out earlier this week, having access to a gun and being able to stand your ground is a human right. In response to Attorney General Eric Holder's comment about stand your ground laws, the NAACP on Tuesday, the NRA released a statement saying in part that, quote, "The Attorney General fails to understand that self-defense is not a concept, it's a fundamental human right. To send a message that legitimate self-defense is to blame," that'd be for the death of Trayvon Martin, "is unconscionable and demonstrates once again that this administration will exploit tragedies to push their political agenda," end quote. As the NRA's $2 million a year spokesman, Wayne Littlepeter, LaPierre, has said, and I quote, "The only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is with a good guy with a gun." So, makes sense. On the night of February 26, 2012, both George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin felt threatened. Zimmerman's lawyers proved with the pictures of his bloody head and bloody nose and with a verdict in the case that Zimmerman felt threatened. And it's safe to assume that Trayvon Martin had a legitimate fear about dying because he ended up dead. I mean, what greater proof of fear for one's death is there than being dead? So for young black men like Trayvon Martin, who are constantly being profiled and stalked by creepy-ass crackers like George Zimmerman, what's the solution? Isn't it obvious? Give him a gun! And pro-gun rights fanatics like Ted Nugent and Rick Perry and late Charlton Heston, they would all agree, right? Check this out.
If somebody close to you were killed by a gunman, would your views on guns change?
Absolutely not. No, I would never turn against this wonderful tool that brings me self-defense capabilities and brings me great joy in competition and marksmanship training.
Something that gives the most common man the most uncommon of freedoms.
Here's Wayne Littlepeter.
When ordinary hands can possess such an extraordinary instrument,
Charlton Heston,
that symbolizes the full measure of human dignity and liberty.
Oh, and this is Rick Perry being a manly man in one of his TV ads. Just shoot away. Now, surely, these guys are not just talking about and showing us how great guns are only for white people. If the NRA is serious about the right to bear arms and serious about the right of self-defense being a human right, then the group needs to announce a new program immediately which would arm every young African-American in the United States. The program should be complete with a website that takes donations of both money and guns to give to young African-Americans. Only then, when an African-American male is profiled and stalked by creepy white guys in the United States, will he, too, have the ability to stand his ground. You think? Oh, man. Somehow I doubt it. We noted yesterday that Obamacare was cutting in half the price of health insurance in New York State. And some weeks ago, it cut by about a third the cost of health insurance in California. And there's a bunch of other states where, as Obamacare rolls out, as the states put together these exchanges, Maine, other states, it becomes increasingly obvious that it is cutting the cost of health care for a variety of reasons. The main one being that all of a sudden health insurance companies are having to compete with each other in public, in the same space, like, you know, in the same states. Right now in most states, or in more than about half the states in the union, the entire healthcare market, or the, you know, well over 80-90% of it, is dominated by just one or two companies whose rates just by magic and coincidence seem to be the same if it's more than one company. So now by setting up an exchange and throwing a half a dozen or a dozen companies in there, suddenly we have something called competition. Now the so-called free marketers on the Reich are not happy about this at all. Obamacare creating competition? We can't have competition. Are you kidding? We're supposed to have monopolies. How is Stephen J. Hemsley, the CEO of United Healthcare, going to make a second $1 billion in compensation if he has to compete? I mean, he might have to sell one of his five or six or seven or God only knows how many homes that guy's got. So the Republicans aren't all that happy about it. And that's one piece of it, is competition, the obvious competition. Another part of it is that the government is regulating these health insurance companies to say, you can only skim 20% off the top. If people are buying health insurance from your health insurance company, and you want to skim 30%, 40%, in some cases 50% off that money that average people like you and me are paying in for health insurance. If you run a health insurance company, you want to skim that money off and you want to pay yourself in stock options and dividends and salaries and corporate jet with gold faucets in the bathroom and retreats to the south of France and golfing vacations to Scotland and all those other things that health insurance companies tend to do. If you want to do that, you can't do it anymore. Sorry. This kicked in like 6 months ago. Under Obamacare, you can only steal 20%. Now, keep in mind, the administration cost for Medicare is 3%. So, and when you look at all the other countries in the world that have single-payer health insurance or have socialized medicine, government-run health insurance, what you see is that the bureaucratic overhead, the cost to write the checks to pay for the providers, the administrative costs, are typically between 1 and 4%. Country after country after country. You look at the Veterans Administration, you look at the Medicare, you look at Medicaid, you look at Canada, you look at England, you look at France, you look at, I mean, you pick your country, 1 to 4%. So we know that that's about what it costs to run the equivalent of a health insurance company. So the Obama administration, and with Obamacare, has said, yeah, you can skim 20% off the top. Now, if the actual cost to run the health insurance company is 3%, you're skimming 20% off the top, you still have 17% of hundreds of billions of dollars that you can pass out to your executives and your CEO and your stockholders. Which, of course, is why the health insurance companies are willing to say, well, it's fine, give us a whole bunch more customers, and we'll go along with that. But the bottom line is that for you and me, our insurance rates are going down. Now, here's where it gets really interesting. All this news has come out, and I've been sharing this with you. It's not being reported in the corporate media. Nobody's talking about it. Isn't that strange?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It couldn't have anything to do with the board of directors, many of the directors on many of the health insurance companies being the same ones as on other big parts of corporate America, do you think? American University has looked into what the Koch brothers are up to. And I think this is fascinating. They did a really in-depth investigative report, one of the most detailed ones of the Koch brothers. And they spent 2 years tracking down how the Koch brothers spent $134 million to, quote, influence policies and politics via the tangled web of nonprofit institutes, foundations, and colleges/universities. And it's really quite remarkable. 19 million dollars that they've donated between 88 and 93 to the Cato Institute. Now that makes sense. That used to be called the Charles Koch Foundation. And Citizens for a Sound Economy. And well, just going through this whole thing, it's example after example after example of how they're either causing us to doubt our system of governance and government, or causing us to doubt the viability or integrity of our political parties, which is, you know, it's a strategy that has been used before. George W. Bush putting a lawyer for a horse judging outfit in charge of FEMA, and then when FEMA screws up during Hurricane Katrina, saying, see, I told you, FEMA can't do anything right. FEMA, which had an incredible track record before Bush got in there. So, you throw money into the political parties, which inevitably corrupts them, and then you point out the fact that they're corrupt, and everybody goes, oh, my God, the political parties are corrupt. Let's vote Libertarian. And the Libertarians, of course, that's the ground that the Koch brothers are standing on. So anyhow, they're up to that. And this is something that David Koch himself told National Journal. He said he views himself as an opportunist. He said, by supporting all these nonprofit organizations, I'm trying to support different approaches to achieve those objectives. It's almost like an investor investing in a whole variety of companies. Yeah, isn't that sweet? I mean, Koch Industries is the second largest privately held company in the United States. I think they pronounce it Coke, but it's spelled K-O-C-H. So for people who want to Google it or check it out, I'm getting a lot of concern from people affiliated with or associated with Coca-Cola, which is a fine beverage and a great tradition of putting cocaine in liquids and selling it to people, that somehow people are mixing up Coca-Cola with the Koch brothers. So probably should. And it's not like with John Boehner, where if you say his name the way it's spelled, it comes out Boehner. That's obviously a dig because, saying Boehner's name the way it's spelled is like, clearly making fun of him because there's a sexual joke in there. But to say the Koch brothers rather than the Koch brothers, I think, is just helping people figure out how to use the DuckDuckGo machine and the Google machine and things like that. Because you got to spell it right to get the information. And if you type in Coke, C-O-K-E, what do you get? Oh, this marvelous beverage. At least if you buy the Mexican version that has sugar instead of high fructose corn syrup in it, which I sort of grew up on. And when my grandfather was a kid, he used to drink that stuff when he was working at the post office back in 1910 or something like that, 1917, whatever the year was. Because it would keep him awake and keep him going because it had a nice little kick of cocaine in it. Which is why it's called Coke. So anyhow, the Koch brothers are up to this, and there's a very, very nice piece written by War on Error over at the Daily Kos, although there's a number of other pieces all over the Internet on this. And I need not go into all the details. I think you can figure those things out. And we're going to get into we've got a great geeky science for you later on today. But it being Anything Goes Sunday, let's pick up a couple calls here. Or, excuse me, Summer. Did I say Sunday? Boy. You can tell what I'm looking forward to. John in Sebring, Florida. Hey, John, what's up?
Oh, well, first off, you've made fun of Boehner's name.
Yeah.
What about Gold Man Sachs?
Okay.
Goldman Sachs?
I see. Yeah, no, I got it. I got it. I got
testicles?
It. Yes,
okay,
yes.
Okay, well, I wanted to say people have said that if the races were reversed on the Trayvon Martin Zimmerman thing, it would have been a slam dunk, and Just get past race and say, what if Trayvon Martin's father was a rich, famous sports star or a police officer or a city councilman?
Or a judge.
Or a judge or
Now, keep in mind, George Zimmerman's dad.
Senator.
George Zimmerman's dad was a judge.
Right, right. If Trayvon was the nephew of a senator,
mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, yep. It would have been a big outcome difference there.
Yeah, I suspect so. I am very curious. And I doubt we'll ever know, but I'm very curious how much deference was shown to George Zimmerman by the Sanford police in the early days of this, and then ultimately.
He was.
And then ultimately, when they showed up and testified at the trial, that they thought he was credible and they liked his story, believed his story.
As if he was already a police officer and part of their.
Well, he used to ride in the cars with them. They all
right.
knew that he was working on becoming a cop when he grew up, and when he grew up, he was in his late 20s, and that his dad was a judge. So, are you really, there's a certain element of, are we going to take on our people? And I'm not talking about racial stuff. I'm talking about kind of subculture within a class stuff. And I think you're right, John. I do. I have no evidence of it. So, we have to operate on the assumption that I'm wrong. But when you look at how these things played out, and particularly look at the lead investigator being the lead witness for the prosecution and then going on the stand and making the defense's case, you got to scratch your head. You just got to scratch your head.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And are the NRA and Ted Nugent really now calling for all young black men in America to be armed? Cool. Before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. McDonald's, by the way, telling their employees who actually make a little more than the minimum wage, generally, minimum wage being $7.25 an hour, they've launched a website telling people how to budget $8.25 an hour. Is that special? Yeah. If you make $8.25 an hour, you make $1,105 a month, according to the budget that they're showing, and I'll just assume that their numbers are right. There is no deduction from that for Social Security taxes or for payroll taxes, which you have to pay. I just don't see any deduction at all. It's pretty amazing when you think about it. Thank you. But anyhow, let's assume that of that $1,105, you're not paying any Social Security taxes, so you're willing to risk going to jail. And that's your full-time job at McDonald's, apparently. I mean, this, And you have a second job that pays you $955 a month. Well, where did they get this number from? Well, they pulled it out of their. Actually, does a corporation have one of those? It is a person, yes. Okay, all right. Well, we'll have to take that one up with John Roberts. Anyhow, so McDonald's is suggesting that with these two jobs that you have, the McDonald's job and the second job that pays $955 a month, that you're going to make $2,060 a month in income, paying out a penny in taxes, including no Social Security tax, although everybody pays, anybody making under $113,000, every single penny you make is taxed for Social Security and Medicare and all that stuff, the FICA, the payroll taxes. Rich people don't pay that. Mitt Romney doesn't pay it on all the millions that he makes after his first $113,000. George W. Bush doesn't pay it. George Bush Sr. doesn't pay it. Bill Clinton doesn't pay it. I mean, wealthy people don't pay that on the money that they make after their first $115,000, $113,000. But McDonald's workers do. But that's not part of the mortgage, that's not part of the budget, rather. So what are they in this budget? What are they suggesting that people pay? What should their budget look like? Well, they're saying, first of all, you're going to spend $600 a month on your mortgage. Good luck buying a house anywhere in the country with a mortgage payment of $600 a month. Or rent, for that matter. I mean, maybe if you're renting your parent, you know, a bedroom in your parents' house, $600 a month. $100 a month for savings. Yes, of course, we've got to have that. $150 a month for your car payment. So you're driving a clunker, okay. How much every month to keep that clunker in good repair? Nothing. No, nothing. Car insurance and home insurance, $100 a month. Okay, that actually might be a reasonable number. It's been a while. I haven't owned a car in 3 years, so I'm not really sure. Or a house. I haven't owned a house in a long, long time. But anyway, health insurance, $20 a month. This is pretty impressive. Now, this must be post-Obamacare. McDonald's, this must be an ad for Obamacare, because with Obamacare, if you work at McDonald's, you do qualify for that government assistance to get your health insurance costs down to the point where it is costing you $20 a month. If we were to go with Rand Paul's formula or John McCain's formula or Mitch McTurtle's formula or any of those other guys, what you would find is, no, it's not going to be $20 a month. Are you kidding? It's going to be $300, $400, $500, $600, $700. You know, if you're over 50 or over 67, $800, $900, $1,000. Oh, you had cancer back 10 years ago? Oh, you had, you know, I mean, fill in the blanks. $1,200 a month, $1,500 a month. A friend of mine was telling me the other day that his health insurance premium is over $1,500 a month. I'm like, wow. Okay, so they're budgeting $20 a month for health insurance. This is, McDonald's has this nice website, right, to help their employees figure out how to do their budgets. Heating. Now, I'm assuming if you lived in Florida, that would be air conditioning as well, right? But if you live in New Hampshire, Vermont, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Montana, Missouri, Colorado, how much you be spending for heating? Zero. Zero? Well, they're assuming you have blankets. I mean, you just walk around the house all day in blankets. You can, you know, you can buy these hoodie things, right? Hoodie footies or whatever they're called. You've seen those infomercials? They go all the way from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet, and they're made out of some magic fabric that's, you know, 100% petroleum. Don't get near open flames. And you can, if you're very, very careful, you can waddle from room to room. And the only time you'd have to take them off is to go to the bathroom. And you can freeze your butt off for, literally, for a few minutes. Okay, so heating zero. I'm not sure how that helps if you live in the southern states. If you're living in Louisiana or in Texas where it's, you know, 100 degrees, or in Arizona where it's 120. I don't think the hoodie footy. I know. You wear the hoodie footy and you soak it. Of course. Every few minutes you walk into the shower and re-soak yourself. How could I have missed that? Okay, heating zero. Cable and telephone, $100. I don't know if that's possible. I know I pay more than that for my phone, but, you know, I've got a smartphone. I suppose if you've got a, for a couple of years, I had one of these really cheap phones, and I got so disgusted by the Verizon plan that we had with it and the service that when our contract finally expired, Louise, and this is when we lived in Vermont back in 1999, Louise and I took it out in our backyard and ceremonially buried it. And for years after that, I didn't have a cell phone. And finally, you know, when I started doing this radio show in 2003, I think it was late 2002, I realized I had to have a phone. And so I bought a Virgin phone, which is you pay month to month. You know, you buy the phone for like $40 or $50, and then you pay nothing except what you use. So my monthly bill would be like $15, $12, $30, whatever. So I didn't use the phone very much. I still don't. So they're saying $100 for your phone and for your cable TV and internet and everything. And maybe it's possible, I don't know. $90 for electricity. That may or may not be reasonable, whether or not you have, you know, lights on at night. Just, hey, live with the sun, right? Or air conditioning. And other $100. Which is totals $1,260. Now, keep in mind, this is for a person working at McDonald's who's earning $1,105 before they've paid their taxes. This is a total of $1,260, which is why McDonald's had to add that second job, making $955, which leaves you a total of $800 left over at the end of the month, or $27 a month in spending money, or $27 a day in spending money. So then, over at CNN Money, they actually did the real budgets of some real McDonald's workers. And here's one from Devont Yates, 21. He's working to get an associate's degree in criminal justice, works 25 hours a week at McDonald's in Milwaukee. He lives with his mom and his little sister. Still, he's got a $180 tuition bill every month. But his income from McDonald's is $525. His mortgage is $250. That's to his mom. Car payment, $90. Cable phone, $90. Other, $530. That's his college. So his total expenses are $960. He makes $525. So he's $435 a month in the hole. These are real budgets of real McDonald's workers. Here's Christopher Drumgold. He's raising two kids on the minimum wage. He makes $7.40 an hour in Detroit at McDonald's. His kids attend a Detroit charter school that doesn't have a bus, so he has to pay for bus or cab fare to get them to school every day. He pays $15 a month for haircuts. Hey, we didn't consider haircuts. Holy cow. $100 on child care, $100 on prescription drugs. None of those things were in the McDonald's budget. He's short $750 a month, bottom line. You know, Teddy Roosevelt famously said, and I will play for you after the break, because this is where the phrase came from, that he believes in a living wage. A living wage is enough in an industrial society, which we kind of no longer have, that you can live a moral life. You don't have to steal to live. You can pay for your children's education. You can buy them books and help them get through school. You can take a vacation. You can cover your medical expenses. Times of sickness was how Teddy said it. Set a little aside for old age and retirement. Not so much anymore. But that's where the phrase living wage came from. It came from Teddy Roosevelt's Square Deal in 1912. It's a recording made by Thomas Edison. I'll play that for you in a few minutes. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Oh, and Louise and I are convinced that our cat Higgins, who was born in rural Georgia, is a right-wing libertarian. I got to tell you about this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, so just, you know, apropos of this whole McDonald's thing. First of all, why isn't there outrage all across the nation that McDonald's is just like making up a budget for their workers that requires them to have a second job and to take the risk of going to jail for not paying their taxes and no heat and et cetera, et cetera? Why is there no outrage? Well, I think George W. Bush said it best when he was giving a speech about how good American workers are, and this woman sitting next to him. He says, you work, don't you, or something like that? And she said, yeah, I work three jobs. And he said, well, actually, here it is.
There's a certain comfort to know that the promises made will be kept by the government. You don't have to worry.
That's good, because I work three jobs, and I feel like I contribute.
You work three jobs?
Three jobs, yes.
Uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that is fantastic that you're doing that.
And all the Republicans
get any sleep?
What did he say? Oh, get any sleep? Ha, 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 yes. Stick the old shiv in there, George. You notice? Uniquely American. You know why it's uniquely American? Because no other developed country would force their citizens to do that. So anyhow, I promised you Teddy Roosevelt, and then we'll pick up your phone calls. I have been, my apologies for putting that off, but yeah, particularly since it's anything goes summer. Here is Theodore Roosevelt. It's a little hard to understand. So, because it is a recording made by Thomas Edison in 1912 or 1913, but it's Teddy Roosevelt talking about his square deal and laying out a living wage. We believe in a living wage, a wage enough in, well, here it is.
We stand for a living wage. Wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living for those who devote their time and energy to industrial occupation.
Hold on just a second. He said, wages are subnormal if they fail to provide a living to those who devote themselves to industrial occupations.
The monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions.
Okay, the monetary equivalent of a living wage varies according to local conditions, of course, but
must include enough to secure the elements of a normal standard of living.
Normal standard of living.
Standard high enough to make morality possible.
High enough to make morality possible. You don't have to steal food. I mean, when he was saying this, there were people whose parents and some of them, I mean, he was saying this back in 1912, there were people who they or their parents had come over here to avoid going to prison because they were stealing food, stealing bread in Ireland. Remember that? So anyhow, he says, enough to make morality possible.
To provide for education and recreation.
To provide for education and recreation. You can send your kids to school and you can take them to the park occasionally or take them to the zoo or take them maybe to the amusement park once a year. Here he continues. To care for immature members of the family. You can buy a crib. You can buy toys for your kids. You can help raise your children.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness.
To maintain the family during periods of sickness. Now, the modern equivalent of that would be you can buy health insurance. Back then, there wasn't so much health insurance because doctors didn't charge that much. And, you know, the hospitals didn't charge that much and everything. But enough to pay for your health care.
And to permit a reasonable saving for old age.
And to permit a reasonable savings for old age. We stand for a living wage. Republican President Theodore Roosevelt. And by the way, he was campaigning on that, and that was when he was campaigning on the Bull Moose Party, and he lost to Mr. Taft, as I recall, and after he had been president for a term and a half. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to, you know, talk about science and enlightenment and culture. And I think that Americans and maybe people around the world are, you know, just very, very, you know, have very muddled thinking about all of this. And religious people, I think, want to state right out, I guess I would say that I'm a Christian humanist, that I, you know, in the tradition of maybe Fyodor Dostoevsky, you know, of course I don't mean to say that I'm as great as he or anything like that, but I do like his ideas. But in my own tradition, you know, the thinking is just so twisted sometimes. I've known two priests that one is an example of, I would say, a humanistic tradition, a Christian humanist tradition, and who made his living teaching at a liberal arts college and also lived in France and fought in the underground. He was sent to Dresden, and fortunately, you know, for him, you know, the bombing started and they let him out of prison and he escaped. But that's a whole nother story. But I wanted to just take these two people and make a comparison. One priest, you know, he wants to, I think, not bring us back to medieval religion, which I think a lot of religion, you know, people in particularly in the Christian tradition want to do.
Many of the fundamentalists do, certainly. You've got a lot of very progressive churches, and even the traditionally more conservative churches like the Methodist Church have become far more progressive in the last three decades.
Absolutely, and for good reason, because, you know, God gave us a mind to use. And then there's another priest who had made his, he was a fundamentalist Christian, and he had made his living as a neurosurgeon in Phoenix, Arizona, and retired. And, you know, he, when I said, you know, when I was putting my plug in for the Enlightenment and modernity, which I do like, I love culture. I'm not into science, but I like culture and art. And, I mean, just think of the centuries that, you know, we have been given, you know, all of these beautiful works of art that may not have happened if we lived in a medieval fashion. But anyway, this priest looked at me like as if I had horns. And I just thought it was really amusing because, I mean, here he made his living as a result of the Enlightenment himself. Science,
right.
Medical science, you know, had gotten to a point where, you know, you could actually operate and save somebody's life.
So he was a physician?
Recently we had somebody in our congregation who, a colleague of his, had saved their life. So yes, it wasn't a priest who prayed over them, and I believe in that too, that there's miracles. But the miracle happened through somebody else's hands.
Yeah. John, I have to wrap it up, but thank you for a thought-provoking entree. I wish we had a little more time to talk about this. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mike Papantonio on the line with us, host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringoffireradio.com, the website, along with Bobby Kennedy Jr. and Sam Cedar. Hey, Pap, how you doing today?
Tom, how are you?
Just great. Just great. Glad to have you with us. There's a new report out. There's actually been a fair amount of this. I mean, Robert Greenwald did a documentary about it. There's a new video out or documentary called Citizen Coke, which I've been trying to figure out how to watch because apparently NPR has buried it after a large donation from the Koch brothers, if I understand that correctly. And now this report come out from the American University, is it?
Yeah, it's American University. The 2 year they tracked the Kochs for 2 years.
Yeah, and I, you know, by the way, I mentioned I've been calling them the Koch brothers. I had Danny Goldberg on my show a couple days ago, and he kept calling them the Koch brothers. And I don't know if he was doing it intentionally or unintentionally, but it occurred to me afterwards, you know, I have had people write to me saying, I can't find any reference to the C-O-K-E brothers when I try to look on the Internet. And
yeah.
And I thought, maybe I should start calling them the Koch brothers so it's easier for people to Google them. But anyhow, you've been looking into this thing with the Koch brothers. What's the deal?
Right now the Koch brothers are in this mode to where they want to start what they call a bounce attack on anybody who really comes out and tells the truth about their history.
Mm-hmm.
And the history is a very ugly history. And so what they've started doing, Tom, is targeting reporters with what they call a bounce method. And here's how it works. A reporter comes out and tells the truth, writes a horrible story about the truth of the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers then have their PR quick, rapid response team place a criticism of that reporter, place the email, the picture, the telephone, the address, how you go after that reporter on all of the suspect sites. For example, they'll give it a guy like Tucker Carlson, who made the interesting statement that, yes, it might not be true, but I would print anything, even if it came from Satan, if it's something that I thought was newsworthy. So they plant these stories about these reporters in just little low-rent kind of sites, and then the idiot media picks up on it because they don't do the background to find out where it came from, to find out whether it's true or not, and they bounce that story, that personal vendetta, that attack against that reporter, into mainstream media.
Right.
And so that's one thing that's going on with the Kochs. It's a fairly new development by the Kochs.
It's new by them, but I mean, if you saw Client Number 9, didn't you? The movie about
sure,
Elliot Spitzer.
Of course.
I mean, that's exactly what they did to Elliot Spitzer.
Oh, there's no question about it. They went after him, and they
not the Koch brothers, but Wall Street billionaire.
Yeah, Wall Street went after him. There's a threat here to the Kochs, and I like this threat, Tom. It's the other side of the story. The other side of the story is Daddy Koch, who is a huge racist, a ridiculous racist.
Fred Koch.
Fred Koch started the John Birch Society. But what Fred did is he did everything below the radar. Fred was of the opinion that you don't get out into the public light because if you do, people start asking ugly questions about you. And when they started, you know, asking ugly questions about Fred Koch, they would find out he was a deplorable racist. He started an organization that really was intent on bringing fascism back to the United States. So what's happened with the little boys, these inheritance babies who got everything from Daddy? Daddy gave them every chance in the world, gave them all their money, gave them all their influence, affluence, you name it. Daddy gave it to them. They're not listening to Daddy. And so because of that, you have organizations like the American University that are coming out and uncovering these horrendous facts that we forget about. For example, we forget about that between 1999 and 2003, that the Coke industries were hit with $400 million in fines. They were charged with price fixing. They were charged with the things that resulted in criminal convictions for other people who worked for them. The story came out that they had been selling armaments. They'd been selling materials, not armaments, but materials to Iran, going behind the embargo, violating virtually a dozen U.S. laws, and just saying, you know, we know that we're in embargo with Iran, but we're going to do this anyway. The stories come out that they made $300 million in overpricing and overcharging, overpumping oil from federal lands. Those stories keep emerging. We start hearing now people surface that worked for the Kochs. We had one of their people come forward, a guy named Phil DuBose, who came out and said that the Kochs developed their own method of cheating, their own method of stealing, and they called it the Koch method. And they told their employees how to go about stealing, how to go about cheating with this Koch method. So they should have listened to Daddy, Tom. They should have listened to Daddy, and that is sometimes it's best to be under the radar, because when you put yourself out there and you live in this humongous glass house, you got to be really careful.
Yeah. Well, and Daddy Fred arguably had a little more to hide, because I mean, the John Birch Society was notoriously anti-communist, and my main exposure to it, other than when I was a little kid, my dad took me to a John Birch Society meeting, but my main exposure was seeing these giant billboards all over the country that said impeach Earl Warren, and that was all about Brown versus Board of Education.
That's right.
But Daddy Koch, Freddie Koch, he made his money with Joe Stalin.
Yes, he did. That story has not been told. People don't even understand that story. But what he did, if you think about it, is different from what the Koch brothers are doing now, is he didn't put himself in the limelight. He didn't subject himself to an Adelson problem. Right now, Adelson is in big, big trouble. It emerged when he put himself too far out there. Had Adelson been a billionaire, enjoyed his billions, kept his mouth shut, went about his life rather than trying to destroy a democracy, rather than trying to destroy capitalism and freedom in this country, Adelson might not be facing the charges that he's facing right now. But people started looking at him, and they'll continue doing that with the Koch brothers. That's the good news here. And I don't care how good your rapid response team is, when you have stuff like this to talk about these billionaire privileged kids that got all their money from Daddy, that are making backstreet deals with Iran to the detriment of America, when you find out that they're actually pumping oil out of the ground to the tune of $300 million worth of oil, and they have to pay a meager $25 million fine for breaking the law. When you start hearing these cases, these stories come up, the Koch brothers really subject themselves to serious, serious scrutiny.
Are there any instances yet of anybody that they have spitzerized, that they have actually taken down, or have they just been firing shots across the bow of people and trying to intimidate people?
Really, it's just firing shots. Sometimes these stories, like David Sasson is the best example I can think of. He's a great environmentalist, a great just a real hero to the environmental movement. He tried to do a story on the Kochs, tried to get information from them, simply printed the truth about what their involvement was with these crazy fringe groups all over the country, secretive fringe groups. They went after David. And what ended up happening is you had you would have a journalist here and there that would buy into this, what we call the bounce, where the story ends up on this nothing site like Tucker Carlson's site. The media then takes that and puts it in and makes it into a legitimate report. Occasionally, you would have a brain-dead reporter that would do that, that wouldn't ask questions. But for the most part, the story died. He tried to do the same thing with the New Yorker magazine, some great reporters with the New York magazine. New Yorker magazine that really told this horrendous, ugly story about the Kochs and just how evil they are. And they targeted one reporter in particular by actually trying to get people to go after that reporter, trying to get the reporter fired, giving personal information out about the reporter, planning it in all of the fringe crazy sites all over the country. But it was never really picked up by legitimate reporters who do their homework. It was picked up by the reporters who are lazy, the reporters who just go after low-hanging fruit.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you, it can be scary. I mean, I did something on Glenn Beck once, and the next day on Fox News, he named me on the air and put my name into the Chyron, and I have never in my life, in any 24-hour period, in fact, I've never in a single month gotten as many death threats as I got the following 24 hours.
Yeah, I've been the same place.
It's amazing. Mike Papantonio, ringoffireradio.com. Thanks, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And be sure to check out Pap's his radio program, ringoffireradio.com. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, Tom Hartman Program. It's Anything Goes Summer, and Peggy in Bend, Oregon. Peggy, you had some something to say about high drug prices?
This guy who called you, who has myasthenia gravis.
Yes, his generic drug went in price from $36 a month to over $1,000 a month, and it's still the same generic drug.
Okay, there is a solution to this.
Mm-hmm.
In two words, it's Canadian pharmacies.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't remember where he was calling from, though. I mean, how does somebody who lives in, for example, Missouri or North Texas or something, how do they, you know, I know a lot of these packages coming from Canadian pharmacies are stopped at the border.
Yeah, well, I have glaucoma.
Uh-huh.
And I've had it for over 20 years, like 25 years.
Right.
And when I went to get the initial medication for it, a one-month supply was, I think, $115 a bottle.
Mm-hmm.
For 30 days. So I contacted Canadian pharmacies, and for the past 20-some years, I've been able to get exactly the same medication for, I think, $22 a bottle.
Wow.
And you get it by mail.
Yep.
And I understand that I can't give out any names or phone numbers because that would violate your terms of government repression there or something.
Variation on that, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's mostly because you know, we ask people not to do that mostly because sometimes people aren't always right, and I don't want somebody to run off and you know, call a pharmacy or check a website or something for something that could be life saving or life threatening like a pharmaceutical if we haven't at least had a chance to check it out first. But a question: Does this pharmacy mail this to you?
Yes.
Are you having any problems with that?
I have never had the slightest problem.
Does it come by U.S. Postal Mail, or do you use FedEx or UPS?
It comes by
or DHL.
USPS, and I get mine from Vanuatu.
Uh-huh.
And it has to come through customs, obviously.
Right,
and
right.
It's marked medication.
Right.
And the value is marked at, I think, $100 or something like that.
Yeah.
You get a three-month supply.
Right, so it's all up front.
At a time. And, okay, this has been going on for 20, 25 years.
Yeah.
So I would say that it's probably been checked out by now.
Yeah, I would think so, too. What's the name of the pharmacy?
The name of the pharmacy is Cross Border Pharmacy.
C-R-O-S-S?
Cross, uh-huh.
Order. Pharmacy. Okay.
I have a phone number.
Well, that's okay. People, you know, people can track them down on the internet, I'm sure, quite easily. And people write down phone numbers wrong, or they can't get to a thing, something fast enough to write it down. But that's enough, and that's great, Peggy. Thank you for calling and sharing that information.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I'm waiting for the item on Higgins.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to talk about that in the next hour. Well, what the heck?
Okay.
I'll talk about it right now. Hey, Peggy, thank you for the call. Here's the deal with Higgins. The other night, Higgins, by the way, you know, we didn't know what's wrong with him. He was throwing up and he was losing weight. And so we took him to the vet. The vet said he either has hypothyroidism or kidney disease. And if he has kidney disease, now the vet didn't say this, but I was wondering, remember when there was that epidemic of that chemical that the Chinese were putting in baby food in China and they were putting in pet food here in the United States? And I think it was called melamine. And it kicked up the apparent protein levels, but it was very, very nephrotoxic, toxic to the kidneys. And Higgins got really sick. In fact, all of our cats got really sick during that period. And I'm convinced that we got a batch of cat food back then that had that stuff in it that was probably from China, which made us worry even more that his kidneys were going. So anyhow, for a week now, he's been on the anti-thyroid medication because thyroid problems and kidney problems look the same, and so you rule out the thyroid first. And he seems to be getting better. He's gaining a little weight, and somebody called in and said, get some baby food, turkey baby food for him if he won't eat cat food. And so Louise did, and she went out to the local store and they had organic turkey baby food with no salt and nothing added, and it was organic, and she got that. And he ate it for a couple of days, and then he quit eating it. And so she went back, and actually it wasn't even she went back to the same store. We were in a CVS the other day, and they had turkey baby food. They didn't have the organic stuff, but they had, you know, just kind of the basic run-of-the-mill baby food stuff, you know, complete with additives and not organic. And we bought that and took it home because it was all we had, and Higgins was out of baby food. And he loved it. So Louise is like, all of a sudden, it got, you know, it was like an epiphany. She just, I'm sitting there on the couch, and Louise goes, I've got it. I said, what? And she said, Higgins is a right-wing libertarian cat. He, first of all, he attacks people. He wanted to be Bush's war czar. I mean, if there was a chance, he would have done it, number one. Number two, he is a me cat, not a we cat. We have three cats. Higgins won't have anything to do with the other two cats. He's like, you know, me first. He's a libertarian, right? No such thing as community. Other cats get along fine. Higgins doesn't. Number three, he's not at all into organic food. In fact, his favorite foods are still, and this is one of the things, you know, I was eating some chips the other night, and he came over and he wanted, yeah, he didn't eat it. Now, maybe it's because it was an organic blue corn chip. Organic. But anyhow, his favorite foods have historically been pizza and chips. And even though he spent 5 years in Portland, he's definitely not a Portlandia cat. And he was born in rural Georgia. You know, I told the story of how our son rescued him from a frat house down at the University of Georgia. And he was a feral cat before that, or at least a stray. So I think Higgins is a right-wing libertarian cat. But that you know, we can just kind of live with that. We've been living with that for 15 years. But the good news is he seems to be getting better. So if you've been sending him good vibes or Reiki or prayers or whatever, thank you for that. And that's my story on Higgins. We will be back with more about the news of the day, my thoughts on it, and your calls about it right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And don't forget, we have a Tom Hartman app over in the App Store. It's free. It's fun. Peter King? Seriously? Amazing. Oh, well, this is over at TPM. They're saying that Peter, you know, Congressman Peter King, the Republican from New York, who famously back before the 2004 election told Nancy Pelosi's daughter, whose name I think is Alexis or Alexa, In any case, she was doing a documentary on the 2004 election. And, you know, it was just like, and this was like just before the election, right? And Peter King was at an event that was on the lawn of the White House. George Bush was president. And he was kind of drunk. He had a beer in his hand. You could see it in the documentary. And he said, basically, George Bush is going to be president. John Kerry. No way John Kerry's going to be president. And she was like, how do you know that? And he said, because we're going to do the count. Or words to that effect. Actually, here's exactly what he said. Here's the clip.
It's already over. The election's over. We won.
How do you know that?
It's all over with the counting. We'll take care of the counting.
It's all over but the counting, and we'll take care of the counting. Yes, that Congressman Peter King. That Congressman Peter King has said that he wants to run for president of the United States in 2016. So, at least according to Newsmax. So, you know, if this is the case, I think the subhead over at TPM says it all. He could be the GOP's loudest candidate since Herman Cain. Right. Anyhow, Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Yeah, I want to talk to you about the coal direct chemical looping process that Lang Shipan has developed.
What are you talking about?
I've actually gotten a PDF on it, and you can, you know, go through the process, and it works. And the
it works to do what?
In other words, you can burn coal without creating a single scintilla of pollution.
No carbon dioxide.
No carbon dioxide, and the byproduct is cement and iron ore, a refined iron ore and cement. So It's like a perfect process.
Yeah, cement is largely calcium carbonate, so you're binding the carbon with calcium. What are the raw ingredients that you have to put into this thing?
What I'm seeing is, like I say, it's iron oxide,
right?
Which is rust, and it actually recycles the iron oxide over, I think, 57%.
Right.
Is all you have to add to it.
But see, mining calcium is a fairly carbon-intensive process because most calcium is locked up as calcium carbonate, and you have to release the carbon dioxide from the calcium carbonate to get mineral pure calcium. And then you're going to bind it back up with carbon dioxide, with oxygen coming out of the process of burning the coal. Is that it? Or, you know, I know nothing about this. I don't know what you're talking about here, but it sounds intriguing.
Well, the point is that we no longer have to be afraid of coal anymore.
Oh, come on.
It can be processed. It can be burned.
Yeah.
And we can get the energy out of it.
Steve, I remember when I was a little kid that the power company in Lansing, Michigan was giving away light bulbs. My dad, every month, we would go through the house and we'd find all the dead light bulbs and we'd take them down and they'd give us free light bulbs. And then why were they doing that? Because they wanted the public to support a referendum to give them money to build a new nuclear power plant, which we ultimately did, because nuclear power would be so cheap, it would be free. There would be no more meter on our house. And, you know, maybe somebody's published a PDF. Maybe somebody has a theoretical thing. I would love to see it, in fact. Post it over at TomHartmann.com on our daily blog. I would love to see it. But that doesn't mean that there aren't people right now all over the world whose lives are being destroyed by coal, ranging from the coal miners themselves, and that's not going to go away with your process, to people who are having to inhale the pollution and the consequence of global warming and all that, which your process may do something for. I would love to know more about it before I go any further, though. Steve, please send us the information. Richard, or post the information. TomHartmann.com, our daily blog on the front page. I read that every day. Richard in Winchester, Virginia. Hey, Richard, you have a theory on Zimmerman's juror?
I do. Tom, you've written books before, correct?
I have written 35 books, 24 of which are in print right now, in 17 languages on five continents.
Excellent. Okay.
Not to brag.
How long did it take
I'm sorry.
You to get your first contract for a book?
Oh, 35 years. I mean, I started writing when I was probably 10, 11, 12. The first rejection slip that I had, I know I was 12 years old. I wallpapered the wall of my bedroom with rejection slips, and I had 56 of them when I was 16 and moved out of my dad's house. So,
okay.
My first book was published in my 40s.
How did this woman who came out for a interview, the one juror who, after Gentile had given her testimony, essentially cut off and Zimmerman was not guilty.
Right.
How, within 48 hours, does she have a book deal?
Well, that's fairly easy, actually. If you are sufficiently high profile in the media, you know, the publishers will come to you. 2 days after 9/11, a publisher contacted me about being in a book. It wasn't exclusively my book, but they were putting together a book called From the Ashes, A Spiritual Response to 9/11. And at that time, I was most famous. I was not on the radio or television at that time. And I was most famous for having been the author of The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight and The Prophet's Way. And the first is about environmentalism, and the second is more about spirituality. And so this was a book that had Billy Graham in it. It had Pope John Paul II in it. It had the Dalai Lama in it. It had Jerry Falwell in it. It had a whole bunch of, quote, religious leaders and thought leaders. Wayne Teasdale, Brother Wayne Teasdale, was in there. It's still, I don't know, I doubt it's still in print, but you can still find it over at Amazon. And that was just a couple days after 9/11. I submitted the article that week, and that book was out within, I think, 2 weeks of 9/11. It's instant books are not that hard to put together. And if you're fairly high profile, publishers are all over you. And they and for that matter, if she's a lousy writer, you know, the publisher will come up with a ghostwriter for her.
Well, how would they know who she is, since she's not no one's supposed to know who she is?
Well, I think that this is my personal theory of this. First of all, it's not that hard to validate those things, right? I mean, you know, if you go to a publisher and you say, I was on the jury, and they say, prove it, anybody who was on the jury should be able to easily prove it. They've got all the documentation from the court. They've got all the papers that they signed. They've got the, you know, there's no shortage of evidence that they were a juror if they want to reveal themselves, number one. Number two, if they want to reveal themselves in a very high-profile way, then they do what this woman did with Anderson Cooper, which adds, in my mind, to the validity of her either having a book deal or being out there and hustling one. What I heard wasn't that she had a book deal. It was that she had hired an agent to get a book deal. Now, there's a world of difference between those two things. I had an agent for the better part of a decade before I sold my first book.
Hmm.
Yeah. So.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Richard. Good to hear from you. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind today?
How you doing, Mr. Hartman?
I
just wanted to tie together three things about food.
Okay.
First, I find very ironic that McDonald's and their employee budget didn't even list food. They had $100 for other, but what, $25 a week for food?
Well, and I think that if you work at McDonald's, you can eat there cheap. I don't know if you can eat there for free. I don't know the rules, but I remember when I was a kid, I was 14 or 15, I used to work at Henry's Hamburgers, you know, and it was like $1.35 an hour, and then we got to buy the hamburgers at I think they were 10 cents each, and retail they were a quarter or something like that. So you can tell how long ago that was.
Okay. Then I wanted to tie together, you said once that Daniel Quinn said that we started to become mentally ill with the agricultural revolution.
Yes, Daniel Quinn did suggest that in his book Ishmael, which I highly recommend.
Correct. And then you said your wife Louise used to spend her summers on her grandma's farm, which is now bought out by some agribiz.
Yep.
So it just seems like food is the issue of our planet. And like you said, Daniel Quinn said that whoever could lock up the food had the power.
Yes.
So, I mean, all these agribiz companies control the food, and we, you know, you said that 30% of the population used to be farmers, now it's only 2%.
Right.
I mean, food is the issue, right?
Absolutely. And secondarily to that, money is meta to food. And, you know, most of these things that have to do with security, whether or not you have a job, that influences your ability to have food. Whether you have money, that influences your ability to have food. Yes.
Correct. All right, thank you, Tom. I don't want to take your time, but it's just interesting how McDonald's didn't even put the title food in their budget there, you know?
Yeah, that is interesting. And, in fact, one of the McDonald's workers, thank you very much for the call, Michael. One of the McDonald's workers said, I think it was the fourth one. It wasn't one of the ones that I printed out, but I continued clicking through the CNN Money website. And one of the workers said that he worked at McDonald's and he ate at McDonald's in order to save money. I remember there was an interesting story. Oh, gee, we did it on this show, but I'm pretty sure it was when I lived in Vermont, so it had to have been at least 6 or 7 years ago, where if you worked at Walmart full-time and you bought everything at Walmart, you could not afford to live. And that's not a knock on Walmart having high prices. That's a knock on low wages. So...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The net of this is when you use McDonald's or Walmart or any of these companies that pay very poorly, you're helping to pay for that employee through your tax dollars. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Shana tells me that Detroit just filed for bankruptcy, and it's the top of the New York Times. I'm going to get over there. And, yep, Detroit goes bankrupt, the largest city to do so in the U.S. Well, Governor Snyder, Rick Snyder, got his way. He figured out a way to bust the unions in Detroit. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service. Talk Radio News brought to you, by the way, by goatsfortheoldgoat.org and .com. And Congressman Ney, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. How are you?
I am well. So with your reporter's hat on today, what's going on in the world?
Well, we've got the bankruptcy, as you said, is the hot-off-the-press news and largest city in the U.S. It's going to be interesting to see how Congress reacts, because I have to assume, although I haven't read it, they will ask for some form of something from the Congress, I would assume, from the administration. But meanwhile, the IRS issue just battles on. It became quite partisan and accidentally almost very personal with a comment made by Chairman Issa referring to a little boy whose hand has been caught in a cookie jar. And later he apologized to Congressman Cummings, who's an African-American, for any potential racial implication using, you know, that word.
Using the word so boy?
I'm sorry, what's that?
Using the word boy?
Yes.
I think we can cut Darrell Issa a pass on that. You pronounce his name Issa. Was he in Congress when you were in Congress, and is that actually how his name is pronounced?
Issa and Issa, we call him the two different names. I guess maybe Issa is correct, but we used to call him Issa.
Okay.
Maybe just to make him angry.
Well, no, I mean, if that's what you called him when you were in Congress, I never knew, and so I'm just curious.
Yes, the two different ways they do it. Yeah. But he did make that reference and, you know, later apologized because it was, from what friends tell me, a little bit of a tense moment.
Yeah.
But the rest of the hearing was contentious. It was he said, she said, and with basically the employees not giving the chairman what he wanted, which is this was a particular thing aimed at Tea Party people.
Yeah. Darrell Issa is really in hot water now because it's increasingly looking like he ginned up a phony scandal. To, you know, one of several, actually. I mean, you've got, you know, the fast guns walking or whatever it was, and then, you know, whatever it was guns walking something done during the Bush administration. Then it became Fast and Furious under the Obama administration. You got that, and then you've got Benghazi, and now you've got the IRS and the Tea Party, and all of these things seem to be, you know, a lot of manufactured outrage.
Well, the Congress has, you know, they've got some smart staff, and if one asks the question in the right way, you get the answer you want, which were any groups on a conservative nature looked at. I won't say targeted, but looked at. Mm-hmm. Once you get the answer to that question, then you run with it, and you know how that runs. Once you tell something long enough, it becomes reality.
Right, especially on Fox News.
Question of who was looked at.
Right.
And I think that's what happened in this case. I don't know how these hearings can go on after this. I really don't. I don't know what else, you know, could be possibly brought to the benefit of the Republican Party's side on this thing. This doesn't have the legs, I think, that people thought it would.
Yeah, I agree with you. We are talking with former Congressman Bob Ney, and now a reporter with the Talk Radio News Service. His new book is out, by the way. It's called Sideswiped. And if you want a mind-boggling insight into how Washington, D.C. works and The Crimes of John Boehner, among others. Pick up a copy of it. Anyhow, what else is going on in the world, Bob?
Well, Tom Perez was confirmed on a pure partisan basis. Of course, they cut the deal with the nuclear war, John McCain, et cetera, you know. And that wasn't fixing the system. That was John McCain cutting the deal to get two appointees off National Labor Relations Board is what they did. But the end result is that now Tom Perez, Labor Secretary, on a 54-46 vote, was confirmed.
You know, okay, so they cut this deal, and they said the Republicans basically said the president does not get two of the people he wanted, but he can get two people that he wants to replace them.
Yeah.
Is that because of the people themselves? They had some objection to those people, or is that they just wanted to be able to go back to their constituents and say, we kicked his butt, we got him to say uncle on at least two nominees or something? I don't understand how anybody won in this thing, or at least on the right.
Partial that, but look, it's a National Labor Relations Board, so the Republicans that are anti-labor are going to be able to say, hey, we stopped this, you know, we cut this deal. They really weren't interested in fixing the process of nominations. They were interested once they cut their deal, which, by the way, if I was Mitch McConnell, the Republican minority leader, I would be pretty incensed because obviously John McCain cuts the deals for the Republican leadership.
Yeah, apparently. But still, the president, I mean, the Constitution says the president nominates and Congress advises and consents. And in this deal, the Senate is not advising or consenting. The president is withdrawing two of these nominees. They're not getting a vote.
That's correct.
So in a way, didn't John McCain undercut executive branch power with this deal? And arguably didn't Barack Obama surrender presidential power, executive branch power via the agency of Harry Reid?
Well, they did because the deal should have been to fix this mechanism and to have up and down votes,
right,
is what the process purification should have been. Instead,
right,
it was a poker deal,
right,
where you pull two people, and so these nominees get a phone call, sorry, nothing was wrong with you, but we can't get a vote, and
right,
then you put two more people in. And so it was pure deal cutting, and it is an undermining of the process. It should be up or down vote.
Yeah. Agreed.
What is supposed to happen.
Yeah. Okay. So what else is up?
Student loans. They fixed it, but I don't think it's anything to exactly write home about. They have a eventual cap of 8.25% on it. It's tied to the 10-year.
So the banksters can still borrow from the Fed and the Treasury at less than a percent, but students have to borrow at 8.25%?
Yes. And that's the
Sweet.
Cap. So, like I said, it's a
He said
fix,
sarcastically.
But it's nothing that I would exactly, you know, brag about in my congressional newsletter if I were they.
Right.
And the 38th vote, or 67th, how you want to look at it, on Obamacare to undo it, to do away with it by the
Right. Right.
I will predict, the bold prediction, it will not pass the Senate.
Yeah, yeah. Nor will it be signed by the President of the United States.
That's right.
The man with the crystal ball, Bob Ney. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you, Bob May. And like I said, this is not a paid advertisement or any kind of advertisement. It's just I read the book. It's a good chunk of it. It's brilliant. Sideswipe by Bob May. Check it out. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And the banks, they're getting bigger and bigger. We will get to that as we continue through the hour. Detroit has gone bankrupt. What does this mean? This is actually... You know, we should get Pastor, what's his name, on the program. Anyway, we should get him on the program from Detroit. He understands the situation there. Actually, there's a number of people. In fact, we could get on about Detroit, but this is going to play out over the next couple of days. But when cities go bankrupt, there's a lot of things that can happen or not happen. And Pastor Bullock is who I was thinking of, but we'll see how this plays out. We'll see how this plays out. I'm I'm very curious. The Trayvon Martin case, the Trayvon Martin killing, the George Zimmerman trial outcome continues to be in the news, continues to be a subject of conversation, although that conversation is increasingly moving in the direction of what do we do about the stand your ground, shoot first laws, and why is it that while George Zimmerman's right to stand his ground and shoot first or use violence was acknowledged, Trayvon Martin's right to stand his ground and use violence, which it was alleged that he punched Zimmerman, was denied. I mean, that was the basis of the prosecution, was that how dare this kid punch this guy? The guy had the right to pull a gun on him. So two different standards of justice? Anyhow, that's a whole other conversation we'll have a little later on. But as I mentioned when I started this hour, the too big to fail banks have become too big to jail banks, and increasingly they're too big to do anything but harm the future of the United States banks. And one of the guys who's trying to do something about that is Senator Sherrod Brown, who represents the great state of Ohio in the United States Senate. Sherrod Brown, Senator Brown, welcome back.
Tom, good to be back with you. Sorry it's not in the studio this time, but...
That's quite all right. It's 82 degrees in our studio right now. I think you're probably doing well if you're over there in the Senate building. You and David Vitter, of all people, announced a new plan that, which in my mind says this must actually be decent legislation to get bipartisan support that's that broad, announced a new plan that would prevent any one financial institution from becoming so large and over-leveraged that it could put our economy on the brink of collapse or trigger the need for a federal bailout. I'm reading from a story, the Dateline Washington, D.C. I'm not sure if it was a press release or an article. Tell us about this.
Yeah, there was interesting. I mean, you mentioned Vitter, and this was a very conservative senator from Louisiana, Republican. And conservatives increasingly are the skepticism they have about big government, which is sort of the thrust of their party in many ways, or the center core of their party, are also beginning to have that same distrust of large banks and the power they wield, the economic power in the marketplace and the political power among regulators and in Washington. And that's really why Vitter and I are teaming up, because I think as a progressive, I've always thought that Wall Street's always exerted too much power in our country, and it's even more so now. That one real quick statistic. Back 20 years ago, the largest six banks in our country combined assets were less than 20% of GDP. Today, they're more than close to 65% of GDP, these six largest banks. They get advantages when they borrow money. They get about a $80 billion subsidy, according to Bloomberg News, about almost a 1% advantage when they go on the capital markets to borrow money. So these banks are getting bigger and bigger because they have economic and political advantage in the marketplace. It's clear that they take risks. They don't practice banking when, as Senator Warren likes to say, more boring banking, which is when bankers actually did their job of traditional banking instead of the risky behavior. And it's a threat to our system and too big to fail. As you point out, it's too big to fail. It's too big to jail. Prosecutors won't go after them. And it's too big to understand and regulate. And even the CEOs of these banks, the banks are too complex to really run safely. So it's a problem, a serious problem waiting to happen, and we just owe it to the public to do this better than we're doing it.
So what's the solution that you're recommending? What are the details of this solution?
Our solution does a couple things. It takes away the safety net insurance that traditional banks have, with the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation insuring deposits. It takes them away from those banks that engage in risky trading. If they're doing traditional boring banking, borrowing money, making loans, not engaging in buying and selling of derivatives and credit default swaps and all the things that Wall Street's done, as long as they're doing that, they keep their federal insurance. That's one thing. But the primary thing is to set higher capital standards. If you're a $10 billion bank, you've got to hold 15% of your assets in some kind of capital cushion, if you will, equity of some sort that really is real capital. And that way, if there's a downturn in the bank and it loses 7 or 8% of value, it's not so-called underwater. and at high risk. But if the banks decide, the banks will do what banks traditionally did, hold back some of their money. It's not like money setting aside, but in some sense it is. It will make these banks safer if they suffer a downturn, and therefore make the financial system safer, making Main Street safer, and that's obviously the whole point of this.
If you withhold FDIC insurance from these big banks, are the people who are banking with those banks at risk?
Good question. I didn't quite say it right. You hold the FDIC insurance, that they still have the safety net in the traditional banking part of those banks. It's only when they engage in risky behavior. So if uh-huh. you're going to invest in these banks and in the derivative side, and you're going to make a lot of money maybe, or you're going to lose a lot of money, that's not taxpayers' issue. If you're going to lose a lot of money, that's your problem. If you're going to make a lot of money, it's your issue, so, and your benefit. So we just want the risky behavior. The taxpayer dollars should never be part of a safety net for risky behavior, because it only encourages it. Because it really is, you know, heads we win, tails you lose to
sure.
taxpayers. And that's what happened in 2009 and 2010.
So this is sort of a, tell me if I'm mischaracterizing this, a somewhat softer blade, but nonetheless a blade not unlike Glass-Steagall, to separate or at least force a behavioral separation between the gambling side of the bank and the traditional banking side of the bank.
Yeah, Glass-Steagall is both narrower and broader in that sense. Our bill does that. That's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
The bigger part is the capital standards.
Okay.
And what we started with, you and I talked on the air about the Brown-Coughlin legislation during Dodd-Frank, where we actually broke up the six largest banks. None of them, they're as large as $2.2 trillion, $2.3 trillion in assets. We were scaling them back to about $600 billion. None could be bigger than that. We're going to work on that legislation later. So there's sort of three tracks here. There's Glass-Steagall. There's the McCain-Warren-Glass-Steagall bill. There's to reimpose that. There's our Brown-Bitter bill to require capital standards. And there's you literally break up the bank bill that no bank can exceed $600 billion in assets that we will introduce.
So this legislation does not compete with Senator Warren's bill.
No,
it complements it.
No, in fact, we will likely co-sponsor each other's bills. I mean, she and I were talking the other day about looking, you know, kind of, I mean, we're both focusing on the one we're working on, each of us. But, I mean, we are obviously allies on the banking committee and will continue to be. And these are not competing. These are sort of three tracks where I think we do all three approaches. Any one of the success of any one of the three would make a huge difference.
I agree. Should people go to brown.senate.gov or sherrodbrown.com or both for more information?
Go to either brown.senate.gov, their website, or government website, sherrodbrown.com. It's our non-government website. Join us at either and get involved.
Check it out. Okay. Senator Sherrod Brown, thank you for being with us.
All right. Thank you.
Good talking with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's good to have good people like Senator Sherrod Brown in the United States Senate. I got to tell you, we are blessed. We'll be back. It's Thursday. Let's get geeky on gold. This is my 3 minutes of science that I get every week. Take a second, look down at your hand. Chances are you're wearing some kind of jewelry, and chances are some of that jewelry is made out of gold. My ring actually is got a little tiny bit of gold filigree, I think it's called, in it. Okay. That gold you're wearing could be straight from the cosmos. The origin of gold has always been a mystery, since it's not formed within stars like other elements like carbon and iron. But now new research suggests that all of the gold on Earth and in the universe may have come from cosmic collisions between super-dense dead stars. According to researchers at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, the collision of two neutron stars, these are incredibly dense, incredibly small cores of exploded stars, could promote and catalyze the creation of gold. Ido Berger, lead author on the Harvard Smithsonian Center study, said in a statement that, quote, we estimate that the amount of gold produced and ejected during the merger of the two neutron stars may be as large as 10 moon masses. That's quite a lot of bling, end quote. Berger and his team arrived at this conclusion by studying a short single gamma ray burst, which is a class of explosions that are among the brightest in the universe. According to the researchers, the burst, which was located 3.9 million light years away from the Earth, in other words, it happened 3.9 million years ago and we just saw it, is thought to be the result of two neutron stars smashing together. The researchers in the study also said that the one single star collision and subsequent gamma ray burst studied produced approximately 1/100th of a solar mass of various materials, some of which was gold. And by combining the estimated amount of gold produced by a single neutron star collision and gamma ray burst event with the number of such events that have occurred over the lifetime of the universe, researchers now believe that all of the gold in the universe may indeed have come from these star collisions and gamma ray bursts. Pretty amazing. Now that, I mean, you know, you look at the gold in your jewelry, if you have any, or somebody near you, and you say, wow, that came from two dead stars, two neutron stars running into each other and colliding. But just look at your hand. Every element in your body, with the single exception of hydrogen, every element in your body was formed by a star dying or by a star burning. Stars start out as giant masses of hydrogen, which is one electron, one proton, one neutron. And that hydrogen starts fusing. Hydrogen molecules under great pressure and temperature fuse with other hydrogen molecules in the furnace of a star. And as they fuse, they form more complex elements with two neutrons, electrons, and protons. They become helium, or I think it's 8 is oxygen, or maybe that's 12 is carbon. And, you know, I haven't memorized the periodic table in years and years, but that number in the periodic table, which is the number of protons, neutrons, electrons, all, you know, any one of those three. Typically, I think the periodic table number is the number of protons in the nucleus. But in any case, that simply tells you what, you know, where it was in the consequence of the star burning. And then, not only are at this moment, you know, you go outside and look at the sun, or don't look at the sun, but, you know, the sunlight that's falling on you, all of that sunlight is created by hydrogen being burned into more dense elements. But then how do those elements become your hand? A star has to die. That star dies, it explodes, and then all those elements, all of them, go out and fill the universe, or at least most of them. Apparently, gold only is created by the combining of two neutron stars. It's fascinating. It's all fascinating stuff. Anyhow, Harvey in Berkeley. Hey, Harvey, what's on your mind today? You want to talk about the NSA and your phone bill? Really?
Well, I was going to talk about the NSA, but you know, the fellow called about clean coal, and I decided to talk about. photovoltaic canal covers instead. Is that all right with you, Tom?
Yeah, although you had what I have on the board here is that you had a question, if the NSA is your partner on the phone, why should you have to pay the whole phone bill? That's a one-liner, and I think it's a great one.
Oh, thanks. Well, yeah, you know, I mean, I got the phone for, you know, my own private number, and then I found that I had a partner. They're using the phone to do their thing, which is collect information on me, and I'm using a phone for my own reason. So I figured, since I have a partner on the phone, why should I pay the whole bill?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, some part of the bill, the NSA. Okay, so you wanted to talk about...
Photovoltaic canal covers. You know...
What is a canal cover? What is a canal?
Well, President Obama, you know the California aqueduct system?
Right.
That's over 100 miles of canals. There's hundreds of miles of canal systems. And President Obama recently talked about opening up the federal lands to renewable energy generation.
Right.
Well, these aqueduct systems, these canal systems, they don't take up space like for solar farms in the desert or in farmland. So
right.
This would be the perfect area, and you can have photovoltaic canopies or photovoltaic awnings or even solar panels that run parallel to the canals, or barges covered with solar panels. And I think that appropriate sections of the national canal system could be used to produce a lot of electricity, and it would also slow evaporation in the canals, keep the water cleaner and cooler, and so I think that this is a way
It's a great suggestion if you can figure out a way to deal with flooding, because they do flood periodically.
Well, these would be structures that would take all that in,
yeah.
And it would, in a way, it would lead to new renewable energy technology
as
well.
But can you just imagine, Harvey, if every house in America, instead of having asphalt asbestos shingles on their roof, had PV, you know, photovoltaic shingles on the roofs, we'd have no energy problem in the United States, or at least no electricity problem. Harvey, great suggestion. Thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing it. It is 28 minutes past the hour. It is Anything Goes Summer on this Thursday. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Indeed. All the gold in the universe came from the collision of dead stars. It's amazing. It's amazing. We're surrounded by miracles. The good, the bad, and the very, very now frigorously ugly, the good. Jimmy Carter, former President Jimmy Carter. According to Der Spiegel, the former president criticized the NSA's spying program at the meeting of Atlantic Bridge in Atlanta on Tuesday, saying that he thought that the invasion of privacy has gone too far. He added that he thinks Edward Snowden's revelations, quote, are likely to be useful because they inform the public. Well said, Mr. President. It's encouraging to see a public figure of your stature stick up for our most important liberties. If only the rest of the Washington establishment would follow President Carter's lead. The bad. Ted Nugent. In his most recent column for the website Rare, the far-right pundit and guitarist encouraged George Zimmerman to file a lawsuit against the parents of Trayvon Martin. He wrote, "The age of majority in Florida is 18 years old. Trayvon Martin was 17 years old when he attacked Mr. Zimmerman, which potentially means that Trayvon's parents may possibly be held responsible for the stress, emotional pain, and anguish their son caused George Zimmerman. Mr. Zimmerman should hire a legal shark to determine if he has grounds to sue Trayvon Martin's parents for the actions of their son." Really, Ted? Last time I checked, George Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin. Emotional pain usually comes with the territory. Trayvon Martin's parents are already going through enough these days, and the fact that you want them to be sued shows just how out of whack your priorities really are. And the very, very ugly, the man who wants to be Virginia's next governor, Ken Cuccinelli. The Republican candidate for governor of Virginia has a great new plan for the old Dominion state. Ban oral sex. Seriously. On Wednesday, Cuccinelli launched a new campaign site that advertises his plan to reinstate Virginia's crimes against nature law after a federal court ruled it unconstitutional earlier this year. The website says that the law is an important tool to stop pedophiles, but in reality, the law's language pretty much covers all so-called unnatural sex acts. It states that if any person cardinally knows any male or female person by the anus or the mouth, he shall be guilty of a Class 6 felony. That's right, a felony. Including married couples. With crazy ideas like this, Cuccinelli better make sure he doesn't stick his foot, or anything else for that matter, in his mouth before the campaign is over. But in all honesty, the Attorney General's plan to save Virginia is to tell you and me what we can do in our bedrooms, and that is very, very ugly. I'm pretty sure I can say that word on the air. It is a clinical medical term, and it was the law. Okay. Still, it's creepy. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, thanks for listening to KBCS. What's up?
And I'm proud to be a KBCS contributor.
Good.
Tom, I wanted to talk to you about your conversation with Stephen Mayer on intelligent design.
Mm-hmm.
Yesterday, Stephen Mayer, PhD, that is. First of all, I'd like to say this. His PhD is in the philosophy of science. It is not actually a science degree. It is a philosophy degree.
Well, his book is mostly about philosophy. I mean, it didn't seem to have a lot of hard science in it.
Well, it doesn't really stand up to much philosophy either. I mean, it's the science of rhetoric, and in his case, yeah. Sophistry, if you ask me. And his tactics, I've heard him before. I'd really like to get him one-on-one on the air. It basically, other than talking over you constantly, is to say that you can't criticize what you don't understand. See, nobody understands intelligent design. That's right. Apparently their first start. But even though intelligent design is a very, very old concept. See, the conservatives are pulling all these old ideas and trying to repackage them. And intelligent design is one of them. In terms of God's intelligence, let's go back to, the 11th century. Anselm of Canterbury, Archbishop of Canterbury, St. Anselm, proposed an ontological argument that God is greater than the greatest thing that can be conceived. So I'm not sure how you recognize God's intelligence if it's greater than the greatest thing that can be conceived. And of course, Thomas Aquinas came along about 200 years later and said we couldn't recognize God's intelligence. Stephen Mayer has a problem also with Immanuel Kant and David Hume, who basically are saying what I've thought, that what kind of intelligence are you really recognizing when you recognize this organization in nature and attribute it to, say, it can't be anything else but God? Kant and Hume would say, well, you're recognizing your own intelligence.
Sure. It's a projection. Although,
it's a reflection of your own.
But Paul, hold on just a second, if you can. Have you read his book?
About the musical scale. It's a completely psychological construct in our own minds.
The dog doesn't care
about it.
No, I don't think you've read his book, because I haven't read the whole book, but I spent some time with it. And it did not seem to me that he was anywhere making an argument for a god or multiple gods or anything. What he was making an argument for, I thought his argument was closer to Plato's argument, mm-hmm. that there is some perfect form, that there is some structure to and within the universe that carries with it the form that we see when we perceive the world around us. Now, I disagree with that. I think that, if anything, a lot of the forms that we see around us are very imperfect. And, you know, evolution is a messy process, and it doesn't always produce perfect things, and very often it produces things. I mean, 0.2% of all species that have ever been alive on Earth are still alive. You know, 99.8% have gone extinct. So
that's an important point that you bring up there, Tom. I wanted to say, where I was going with the original thought was that he says digital information, it always comes from intelligent sources, and I was going to say, well, what intelligent sources do you know that use digital information other than humans? That's with regard to reflection of our own intelligence.
Well, and beyond that, binary stars produce digital information.
Darwin's book, I read it, and I would say I have a bioscience degree from Michigan State University, so
okay.
I think I'm at least...
By Darwin's book, are you referring to The Fall of Man, or are you referring to The Origin of Species?
I read part of it when I was a student, and I just read the entire thing about 4 months ago.
Origin of Species. Okay. You really need to read The Fall of Man. Which I read 3 or 4 years ago. I was going to write a book on it, and then I discovered that a friend of mine had written a book on it called Darwin's Lost Theory of Love, because Darwin basically repudiated much of his own, at least many of the assumptions that people were drawing from his own work in Origin of Species, and came to the conclusion that really what promotes evolution is not the tension and terror of nature. It's not the tooth and claw of nature. It's cooperation and collaboration. And that the essential nature of progress, it has to do with cooperation. And the essential nature of humankind and of mammalian kind, as far as he could tell, animal kind, is love.
I wanted to say that Stephen Mayer talks about the Cambrian explosion and how Darwin had problems with that. No, he didn't. He addresses in chapters 14 and 15 the fossil record. And what he says is that the fossil record is incomplete. It's not a running ledger. We can't look at it and say, oh, this is what happened and that's what happened. He says, no, as you say, most of these species have gone extinct. We'll never know what they were. Never know. Matter of fact, a good example, Tom, is that, 90% of the plant species vegetables and fruits and vegetables that used to exist in the United States 150 years ago are extinct. We'll never know now what they were,
right,
except that we have records of them. But in terms of the Cambrian explosion, you can take a look at it and say, oh, look what must have happened. No, Darwin addresses that. He says the fossil record is incomplete, and therefore we can't know.
Right. Here's what baffles me, Paul. What baffles me is why he is trying to attribute coarse form, and this is what Kant was dealing with, and Descartes, I suppose, to a certain extent, why he is trying to attribute, and even Plato, why he's trying to attribute coarse form, in other words, the human body, to a supreme intelligence, rather than simply the existence of the universe. I mean, the deistic position that was taken by Thomas Jefferson and the deists of his day was that there is some sort of mass intelligence that is the universe, or that represents the universe, or that just kind of, you know, blinked its eye, to use a metaphor, because nobody was positing that it had a face to blink, but that kind of noticed itself in just a second, and in that second, boom, all creation came into being. It came into being according to natural laws that were defined by the nature of the creation itself, and that everything else was the subsequent result of those natural laws unfolding. And that doesn't require any intervention by any intelligent creator from the moment of the Big Bang till today.
Right.
And that actually makes sense to me.
Actually, I read his autobiography. Darwin actually thought that he discovered intelligent design. He discovered the intelligence behind the design that the creator, as he called it. And Darwin does refer to the Bible. He refers to the book of Genesis in chapter 2, mm-hmm, or the chapter 1. But he doesn't deny there's a creator. He simply says there was a natural process that goes, that the creator has left there.
Right.
It doesn't necessarily need an intelligence. It's running on its own. By the way, I wanted to point out something you said about the atmosphere used to be mostly sulfur and nitrogen. And then he says, well, how did all of these oxygen-breathing organisms suddenly occur? This would take this great sudden adaption in DNA that mutation is like magic. No, actually, sulfur and oxygen, first of all, they're in the same class. They're class 6 elements.
Right. They're in the same level in the periodic table. And secondly, it took hundreds of millions of years, by the way, for that to happen.
It's not such a big leap, because they're very similar elements in their function, and they're still used.
Right. And there are actually still bacteria that use and
you're
hang on
listening
second
to the Tom Hartman program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
There are still microscopic plants and animals in the deep sea vents that live off sulfur rather than oxygen. Bit of sulfur-based metabolisms. So anyhow, Paul, thank you for the call. GRB 1306038, that was the gamma ray burst. It was located 3.9 billion light years. And this is interesting. I did not know that gold was not formed within stars like the lighter elements. Apparently, the very, very, the denser elements, the higher, I need to print out a periodic table. Apparently, just the first couple rows of the periodic table are formed within stars by fusion. And then the denser elements, or at least gold, is formed by collision, by superfusion. It's very rare in the universe, as well as being very rare on Earth. These are those moments when I wish I had a chemist or an astronomer that I could just make a quick phone call to. Maybe there's one listening. If you know the answer, at what level on the periodic table where are those elements formed? I'm curious. Rich in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, says you disagree with me. Why?
Well, Tom, I always listen to your show, and I agree with you on most things. But you know, this is a free country. We got a right to profile whomever we want.
Doesn't mean you have a right to kill them.
Well, profiling and killing. When I talk about killing, I'm talking about profiling.
But Trayvon Martin's dead. Somebody killed him.
Well, if I see someone suspicious around my house, I'm going to ask them, what are you doing here?
Yeah, but when profiling leads to killing, how can you untangle the two?
Well, I'm just talking about profiling here. You know, it's a free country, and if I see, you know, someone that doesn't look right or in my neighborhood, you know, I'm going to...
You know, Rich, we all constantly profile all the time. I mean, you know, you're walking across the street, you're looking at the car coming down the street, you're asking yourself, is that car going to hit me or is that car going to slow down?
So are you saying profiling is okay? That's what it sounds like.
I am saying that it is natural for human beings to make judgments about other human beings, whether they're right or wrong. And you can call that profiling or not. I think that what George Zimmerman did in the case of Trayvon Martin was not so much behavioral profiling as it was racial profiling. And again, that's something that all people do. That's a natural part of humanity. However, when you're in a position of authority, when you're carrying a deadly weapon, when you are appointed as a law enforcement officer or even as a neighborhood watch person, you have an obligation not to act on profiling, but rather to act on genuine and reasonable suspicions and to act in a way that doesn't lead to the death of somebody.
Yeah, how about all those break-ins going on in the neighborhood? You know, there was all these burglaries. News doesn't even want to touch on that for some reason.
There was one burglar in the neighborhood.
They had descriptions of attackers, and they were black men.
There was one burglar in the neighborhood. It was apparently committed by two.
Why do you think the homeowners were all upset about it?
Yeah. Well, let's say there were multiple burglars.
They're all going to get book deals. They're all going to be millionaires.
Yeah, I doubt that. I doubt Trayvon Martin is going to get anything. He's dead. And I think that's what we have to keep in mind. And if he was my child, I would be devastated. And I would hope, Rich, that the same would be true of you. Judy in Roseburg, Oregon?
Yes.
Hey, Judy, what's up?
I wanted to talk. I know this is old, but West Texas, have you heard that anyone ever went to jail on this?
You're talking about the town that blew up because the fertilizer factory was illegally storing explosives.
4,000 pounds of explosives. Someone had to know that wasn't right.
Yeah.
I realized they weren't inspected, but they had to know the law was 400 pounds.
Yeah.
And someone loaded this place up. They weren't out in the middle of the desert. They were in a town.
Yeah. Judy, to the best of my knowledge, nobody has gone to jail, but I may be real wrong. I have not seen any news stories on it. It's the kind of thing, this is corporate crime, and it's the sort of thing that the corporate media in the United States typically does not report on. If a corporation commits a crime, they may report that Citibank paid a small fee. They don't go into any of the detail about the drug laundering that they did or all the people that died as a result of those drug runners or any of that other stuff. I just don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to the question. Judy, thanks for calling and making the comment, though. Sue tells me about the universe. Of course, I should have known. Sue Nethercutt would know this. The folks in our chat room would know this. Sue writes, during the formation of the universe some 14 billion years ago in the so-called Big Bang, only the lightest elements were formed, hydrogen and helium, along with trace amounts of lithium and beryllium. As the cloud of cosmic dust and gases from the Big Bang cooled, stars formed, and then they grouped together to form galaxies. The other 86 elements found in nature were created in nuclear reactions in these stars, and in huge stellar explosions known as supernova. Now that, dig this story out. Hang on just a minute here. I tossed it in the trash. Shouldn't do that. That somewhat contradicts this article by Miriam Kramer in Space.com, published in Science, NBCNews.com, Science story. All the gold on Earth might have come from cosmic crashes between super-dense dead stars, new research suggests. So I can't reconcile those two pieces of information. Maybe, Sue, you can figure out how to reconcile it. If so, we'll have to figure it out tomorrow, because tomorrow's anything goes Friday, too. Very, very quick question, Cora, listening on KVOT in Taos, New Mexico. We have about a half a minute here before the show is up.
Yes, I was wondering, you know, McDonald's didn't figure in the budget for a London Fog raincoat because you don't want to be seen in public in a, you know, a hoodie.
Okay.
And then every member of your family needs a weapon along with all the ammunition and, you know, the fees to the shooting range.
Right. So McDonald's budget was a very, very useless budget. Excellent point, Cora. Thank you for the call. Thank you. Yes, McDonald's is assuming you're wearing a hoodie. Well, maybe not. There wasn't even a hoodie in that budget. I don't recall clothing in that budget. Oh, of course. McDonald's assumes you live in a nudist colony when you're not at work. Coming up tomorrow, it's Friday. That means it's Brunch with Bernie, Senator Bernie Sanders, America's senator, taking all the talking about all the important issues of the day and answering your questions, too. Plus, anything goes on Town Hall Friday, what do you want to talk about? And don't forget, democracy is not some kind of game. It's not a spectator sport. It's not something you read about in the newspaper. It's you! It requires your participation. Get out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.